To get a job, the students should be long enough on family connections, long enough on ability, or long enough on personality, or a combination of these. Something called acceptability is made up of the sum of its parts. If a man has any of these things, he could get a job. If he has two of them, he can have a choice of jobs. If he has three, he could go anywhere. Bickle's hair was not fair. His eyes were not blue. He spoke with an accent, and his family connections consisted, principally, of being the son of Solomon and Yetta Bickle of Bucharest, Romania, by way, most recently, of Brooklyn. Flom's credentials were no better. He says he felt uncomfortable when he went for his interviews downtown, and of course he did. He was short and ungainly and Jewish, and talked with the flat, nasal tones of his native Brooklyn, and you can imagine how he would have been perceived by some silver-haired patrician in the library. If you were not of the right background and religion and social class, and you came out of law school in that era, you joined some smaller, second-rate upstart law firm on a rung below the big names downtown, or you simply went into business for yourself and took whatever came in the door, that is, whatever legal work the big downtown law firms did not want for themselves. That seems horribly unfair, and it was. But as is so often the case with outliers, buried in that setback was a golden opportunity. The old line Wall Street law firms had a very specific idea about what it was that they did. They were corporate lawyers. They represented the country's largest and most prestigious companies, and represented meant that they handled the taxes and the legal work behind the issuing of stocks and bonds and made sure their clients did not run afoul of federal regulators. They did not do litigation. That is, they rarely had a division dedicated to defending and filing lawsuits. As Paul Cravath, one of the founders of Cravath, Swain & Moore, one of the very whitest of the white shoe firms, once put it, the lawyer's job was to settle disputes in the conference room, not the courtroom. Among my classmates at Harvard, the thing that bright young guys did was securities law or tax, another white shoe partner remembers. Those were the distinguished fields. Litigation was for hams, not for serious people. Corporations just didn't sue each other in those days. What the old line firms also did not do was involve themselves in hostile corporate takeovers. It's hard to imagine today, when corporate raiders or private equity firms are constantly swallowing up one company after another, but until the 1970s, it was considered scandalous for one company to buy another company without the target agreeing to be bought. Places like Mudge Rose and the other establishment firms on Wall Street would not touch those kinds of deals. The problem with hostile takeovers is that they were hostile, says Stephen Brill, who founded the trade magazine American Lawyer. It wasn't gentlemanly. If your best buddy from Princeton is the CEO of Company X, and he's been coasting for a long time, and some corporate raider shows up and says this company sucks, it makes you uncomfortable. You think, if he goes, then maybe I go too. It's this whole notion of not upsetting the basic calm and stable order of things. The work that came in the door to the generation of Jewish lawyers coming out of the Bronx and Brooklyn in the 1950s and 1960s then was the work the white shoe firms disdained, litigation and, more importantly, proxy fights, which were the legal maneuver at the center of any hostile takeover bid. An investor would take an interest in a company. He would denounce the management as incompetent and send letters to shareholders trying to get them to give him their proxy so he could vote out the firm's executives. And to run the proxy fight, the only lawyer the investor could get was someone like Joe Flom. In Skadden, the legal historian Lincoln Kaplan describes that early world of takeovers.